Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
There's this notion of, yes, I wasn't just elected to pursue my platform, I was elected to somehow or another vindicate some larger cause, and you're the enemy and you have to be vanquished. That's recipe for the disaster.
We check in on the State of the Union as the United States prepares for one of its most anticipated elections in decades. I'm joined by the former mayor of the country's capital to get his view on the things that mattered most during his tenure at the helm of Washington, D.C., as well as discussing some of the important factors to consider for American cities looking beyond the current administration. We also take a closer look at some of the urban issues that have sprung up during the past 4 years with Donald Trump in the Oval Office. That's all coming up right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. We're just days away from an historic election, the likes of which US citizens have never seen before. All eyes are on the US right now, and on today's show, we wanted to look at how cities are impacted by who takes up residence at the White House, and how those in charge, from city mayors all the way up to the occupier of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, can influence what goes on at street level. Well, I'm joined today to discuss the past, present and future of American cities by the former mayor of the country's capital, Anthony Williams. Anthony was mayor of Washington, D.C. from 1999 to 2007 and is now the CEO of the Federal City Council. Anthony, thank you so much for joining us. First, I wanted to talk to you about a recent award you received, the Prize for Visionaries in Urban Development from the Urban Land Institute. When you look back at your tenure at the helm of DC and what this prize is recognising, what are some of the ways that you implemented your vision to deliver change in the city?
Well, I think my vision, in a focused way, was really around rebuilding the city, focusing on the neighborhoods and where we could prioritize our different neighborhoods in different ways based on their level of need. All neighborhoods should get attention from the city, but different neighborhoods and different topologies and different circumstances require different interventions. So, you know, it's not a question of do or don't, it's a question of how you intervene. And so, you know, where was the real estate wave? Where could we productively intervene where there actually was a rise in prices and investor interest? And then farther afield, where could we make key infrastructure investments? Maybe it was major transpositions of land, moving government agencies, encourage long-range investment in those neighborhoods, human service investments in those neighborhoods. So neighborhoods were a big initiative. Streets like 14th Street or H Street, recognizing that great streets are part of making a great city, so refurbishing these streets initially by making the key government investments that would invite the private investment to follow, the downtown core, major investments in sports and entertainment, convention center, building on what had happened with a major sports arena in an area called Gallery Place, 8th Street Barracks Row, which gets me to waterfronts and a major emphasis on the waterfronts, particularly the Anacostia River. And in focusing a vision for the Anacostia River, not only focusing on the waterfront as a showpiece for the city, a center for investment in the city, I think an opportunity to show inclusive development in the city, also an opportunity to essentially broaden the lens, the focal lens, when you look at Washington, D.C. from simply the National Mall to include more of what we call in Washington, D.C., the people city, not just the federal enclave. So I would say those four things were really part of it.
You use the important phrase inclusive, and I know that for all mayors there's an interesting balancing act between regeneration and the things that that can bring as gains and wins, and then the fact that sometimes in that process it's difficult to keep the connections with communities who feel that perhaps progress is at their expense, at their cost, and that they get displaced or that they don't feel they're part of the same journey. In a city like DC, which is richly multicultural, where many communities may not feel that they have the same access to power, how difficult was it to articulate that need to regenerate the downtown core, to change the waterfront, but to also explain to people how they could be part of that journey?
I think it was difficult, but I tried to basically tell a story. I always use a hokey analogy of how the city was a badly driven, overloaded, underpowered car on a tough road, on a rough road. Well, the rough road is it's hard being a city. The badly driven car is that previous governments hadn't done a good job in running the city and driving the car, if you will. Underpowered because, like many American cities, in Washington, D.C. in particular, a lot of revenue isn't available to the city, not just because of economic history and the lack of investment, but just arbitrary laws that were put in place. Washington, D.C. doesn't have representation. We didn't really have access to about 60% of our tax base. And then overloaded in that, you know, the American city, and I think I've worked with the Urban Age and London School of Economics on cities around the world. I think this is true in many cities. There's a tension in the city between managing your finances of your city itself. That's, you have a stewardship there, and a broader vision for the city of uplifting people, which is important, but it's that tension with keeping your finances in order. I'm not saying you don't try for the latter. You have to, but you have to always understand there's a balance there.
And tell me, I know that in many of the interviews you've given and many of the profiles that have been done of you in the past, this notion of being a careful financial controller, somebody who understood how the budget was run, was very important to you, and the need to balance the books. You have a past in the world of city finance, but why is that so vital, do you think, to good governance of a city like Washington, D.C., or any city, to make sure that you are balancing those books?
I want to write about this one day. I mean, I think when you're running a city, you're responsible for the cultivation and sustainability of the public realm, not just a physical space, but a community. And the center of this community is public trust, accountability, transparency, faith and credit, all those kinds of things, settled expectations. If people don't have that, it's impossible to build the public services, the public education, the public safety, the public amenities on which a vibrant community is built. So people have to have that trust, and that's why the finances are so important. Now, I believe that, you know, investors are willing to come to a place. They're always pioneer investors. All you have to show them is to steady things and show them that things won't get worse, and then start building a positive inertia and a positive cycle.
Can I ask you, if you were giving advice to the current mayor, to Muriel Bowser, to a new mayor for a city like Washington, D.C., it's an extraordinary time for anybody because, you know, we have the world of COVID. We have some very strong cultural issues being played out in our cities, especially in Washington, D.C. You know, you've always been clear that you need to have a vision. You need to know where you're going, what the plan is for your city. But at a time like this, is it almost impossible for a mayor to know what to plan for? Because it just seems such a difficult moment. Do you think it's still possible to have that vision thing as you look at a city when you're sitting in City Hall these days?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's from a point of, use the analogy of navigation, you still know where north is, I think. You still know the general direction of where you want your city to go. Now, obviously, there are changes. I mean, your economic model is under threat or under question because you don't know what commuting patterns are going to be like, office space is going to be like, people's preference for density, what that's going to be like over the short, medium, long term, you know, the state of your various sectors of your economy, all those are, yes, in question. But you know that you want to continue to build your economy, you want to continue to make your city the kind of place that people feel safe and where people feel at home. And so pointing in that general direction, maybe 30% of your time, you know, yes, about 60% of your effort now is just simply building in resiliency and being responsive to all this uncertainty. You know, people tell me, well, why should I plan? There's so much uncertainty. And, you know, actually, with the amount of uncertainty we have, it really takes a lot of, maybe not planning isn't the right word, a lot of preparation so that you're able to move and improvise and adjust on a moment's notice. Maybe it's going from a kind of like a American football, which is kind of very planned and, you know, methodical, to world football soccer, where it's much more improvisational. You know, you need that resiliency is what I'm saying. You need to prepare your team for that resiliency so that they can be responsive. And I felt the best way to do that was I had this series of citizen summits where thousands of people would come to the citizen summit. That was your early warning radar, because you were able to listen to people and get advance notice of where things were changing and where things were moving a foot beneath you.
Like many capital cities, you're often overshadowed by the key resident who happens to be in town, which at the moment is Mr. Trump. How much does that impact what happens in DC, having him in the White House? How difficult a period do you think it's been for the city, for cities in America, to change course, to be responsive to things like climate change, to be responsive to the Black Lives Matter campaign? What do you see as the impact of Donald Trump on U.S. cities?
You know, in a policy way, there's a retreat from an emphasis on sustainability, you know, global warming, climate change. So that's a problem. There's been a de-emphasis broadly on real federal involvement in cities. There's been a retreat from that, with a notable exception of opportunity zones. But even there, and I'll get to this in a moment, there hasn't really been an emphasis. And then on top of all that, there is just a political posturing. You know, you've got the Democratic mayors versus a good, well-run, beautiful red city mayors. And mayors don't look at one another that way. They really have much more comedy among one another than national politicians do, because they just have to work out things on a local level. There's much less acrimony on the local level between mayors than you would think listening to the White House. And then lastly, it's just the lack of predictability. I talked about settled expectations. It's just very difficult to work with the White House.
You worked with both Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. Did they have a vision for what they thought cities could and should do? Or were you in similar territory where, in fact, they are focused on national and international concerns, that city mayors are left to kind of make their own union of leadership to navigate all these choppy waters?
No, and both President Clinton and President Bush, in their own ways, from their two ideological perspectives, saw Washington, D.C. as a partner. I mean, we worked with the Clinton administration on a number of initiatives. After 9/11, we worked closely with President Bush on the, whether you agree with it or not, the formulation and the construction, institutionalization of a homeland security apparatus. You know, I worked on the president's Homeland Security Advisory Council. So we had a very close relationship with both administrations. And I think a mayor in any capital city has to do that. I mean, the mayor of London, I mean, I hope he has got a good relationship or try to have a good relationship with Boris.
I think he tries anyway. But tell me, you know, around the world, we've seen since the killing of George Floyd, these extraordinary demonstrations taking place in many American cities. And Washington, D.C. has been the center of many of those demonstrations and demands for change about how African Americans are treated within cities, and everything from the funding of police to the defunding of police have been important issues that everybody has had strong opinions on and wants to debate, and have also fed into this presidential election. When you look at Washington, D.C., do you think the city has particular problems that are just difficult to navigate? Or do you think they have been stoked by the last period of power under Donald Trump?
Well, I think all cities, including Washington, D.C., have continuing work to do at varying degrees to improve their policing, the conduct of their police officers, to make sure that the few police officers, and I do believe it's a few, the exceptions don't prove the rule, that there's the right accountability. I talked about transparency, so that officers who violate norms of conduct, codes of conduct, appropriate regulations and laws are sanctioned. And Washington, D.C., we were one of the first cities to voluntarily enter into a consent agreement with the Justice Department to improve our police practices. So we've come a long way. We had a bad record, and we've improved that, but we can still improve that. And I think there are ways we can do that. And then the second part of this is, again, how you look at a problem, how you adjust your lens on a problem. We need to broaden our focus here. So when we're talking about public safety, it's not just a technical, tactical, ersatz military point of view, but it's a broader, holistic point of view. It's not about defunding the police, but it is about responding to incidents in the appropriate way. Maybe it's police resources, maybe it's other human service resources in concert or in some kind of alignment. That's what we need to think about. And I think a lot of work has to go into that. And then lastly, we just got to recognize that we still have a serious problem of just getting crime down. It's been stubbornly, you know, violence has gone down in the American city over the years, but it's still stubbornly resistant to change in South Side of Chicago, even in LA, right, where it's been noticeable reduction still in South Central, in Washington, D.C., and Southeast D.C. You know, it's unacceptable when kids can't go to a picnic with their parents and be safe.
My thanks to Anthony Williams. We'll be back with you in a moment. Now, observers of U.S. politics will have noticed that the Democratic Party finds it easier to win the national popular vote than to take control of Congress. In his book, Why Cities Lose, the Stanford political scientist Jonathan Rodden argues that this is because support for the Democrats is concentrated within urban areas, which the US political system is biased against. He recently spoke with Monocle's acting New York correspondent, Henry Reece Sheridan.
Well, I think everybody knows already about the US Senate and the extent to which it overrepresents sparsely populated rural areas, and that's been the case for a long time. And there's a lot of debate about the Electoral College, and there's some understanding about the ways in which that overrepresents rural areas. But what people have paid a lot less attention to, and what the book focuses on, is majoritarian democracy in general. So using winner-take-all districts in a context where votes for parties of the left are highly concentrated in cities. So there's an inefficient distribution of support for parties of the left so that their votes translate into seats less efficiently than do votes for the party of the right. And so that's true in the U.S. House, and it's true in many state legislatures. And in the book, I also look at Britain and Canada and Australia and some other places with similar institutions.
So to try and illustrate this mechanism, basically, Democrats tend to carry urban districts by a very, very, very wide margin. So you can think of those extra votes, the huge margins that they win by, as quote-unquote wasted, in the sense that they don't get any more representatives from those districts than elsewhere. And then in terms of the way that their vote is distributed outside of urban districts, they don't have enough in enough other districts to win by a majority. And so those votes are also, quote-unquote, wasted in the other direction.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And it's an observation that was made already in the 1950s by political geographers looking at the distribution of Labour Party vote shares in Australia and New Zealand, and also in the UK, where in the early days of industrialization, these Labour parties would win by overwhelming majorities in these urban districts that had lots of working class voters. And so we see something similar in the US now. There's a lot more to it than just labor politics and class politics. There's a cultural component and a lot more to it. But parties of the left, in the U.S. case, the Democrats, end up with the very large supermajorities in the urban districts, as you described, something on the order of 75, sometimes 80%. But the interesting part for representation then is to ask, well, what happens outside the cities? If it was the case that the rural districts were also 80% conservative, then you would just have a kind of a bimodal distribution, and it wouldn't affect representation in the way that I describe. But what's interesting in the U.S. context is that these, what we think of as rural districts, are actually quite heterogeneous, and many of them include small cities, small, slightly denser areas that are majority Democratic. So that you end up with what we think of as a rural district might be a place that is 60-40 or something like that. It's very hard to find an 80-20 rural district in the United States.
A really interesting point that you touch upon in your book is the way that geography shapes the Democratic Party's ideology, shapes its platform. So you write that there's this kind of tug of war within its supporters between what you call urban purists and suburban pragmatists.
Because of what we've been discussing, the concentration of progressives in city centers, the base of the party is urban. And within the party, those incumbents, those powerful legislative incumbents in cities have a lot of power, and they'd like to pull the party platform out to some place where they feel comfortable, which might be quite far from the median district that the party needs to win in order to form a legislative majority. And so that creates a lot of tension within the party of the left, in this case, the Democrats, between these urban representatives in places like the Bronx and San Francisco on one end, and the places that they need in order to hold on to the legislative majority, which are places like suburban Oklahoma City, South Carolina, and places like that.
Obviously, approaching this 2020 election, that urban purist, suburban pragmatist rift within the Democratic Party, I think, is very pronounced. Historically, are there precedents of this tension resolving itself? And how does that normally take place? I think one of the most prominent, relatively recent examples would be something like Tony Blair's New Labour administration in Britain that won in 1997, 2001 and 2005, kind of unifying these two branches. Do you anticipate a similar resolution on the horizon for the American Democratic Party or not? And how do you think it'll come about or not?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I do think a lot about the case of Tony Blair and Great Britain, because this is an example of a party that had exactly this problem of winning comfortably in its urban bailiwicks, but not being able to win in the crucial suburban constituencies that were required for a legislative majority. And under Blair, the Labour Party was able to, these kind of suburban-friendly moderates were able to take over the party platform, and in some cases angering the urban purists. And so for a time, it appeared to everyone like the Labour Party had finally solved that problem at the heart of my analysis. But my sense of it is that that was a temporary solution, and eventually the problem came back. This tension on the left got the better of them again. So in the United States, I do think we're at a moment where already in the 2018, what we refer to as the blue wave election, the Democratic Party was able to win a lot of suburban constituencies that have been Republican for some period of time. And so we're at this moment as well, I think much like Britain after the Blair takeover of the Labour Party, we're at this moment where the Democrats might be tempted to believe that they have solved their geography problem in the sense that they've been able to form decent majorities in pivotal suburban constituencies. But then the danger is that once the party is in power and has to negotiate this divide between the urban purists and the suburban moderates, if they don't do so successfully, they could easily lose those places again and be right back where they started. And I think that's a question to which we need to have several years before we'll know the answer. A lot depends on how the party's platform evolves and how people's perceptions of that platform evolve in those pivotal constituencies.
That was Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan speaking to Jonathan Rodden about his book, Why Cities Lose. Well, still with me is the former mayor of Washington, D.C., Anthony Williams. Now, Anthony, we've heard about the urban-rural divide in the U.S. there, but sitting in between the two sides are the suburbs. This is an area that's come to the fore during the pandemic as people have been encouraged away from offices and city centres. Sadly, just after progress was being made to revitalise the core of many American cities. What do you think the role of the suburbs is going to be going forwards in cities like Washington, D.C., and of course, elsewhere too?
If over the medium and long term we have a hard time, if we go beyond 2022 and we're not making real progress through a vaccine to achieve the, it's like the holy grail now, this herd immunity, then I think you are going to see major shift in commuting, settlement patterns, investment. And you will see, or maybe again, the fourth cycle of the city where we had the growth of the city, decline of the city, the rebirth of the city, and the decline again, maybe. I happen to think that we'll make progress on COVID and that, you know, I believe the gravity, if you will, you know, the centripetal force of a city is eternal. If you look at Beijing, London, Cairo, Athens, I mean, these cities have survived war, pestilence, bombing, plagues, and they're still around. You know, short, medium term, who knows? But in the long term, I think cities are going to be what they are, and they'll continue to attract people who are there for the innovation, the intellectual, cultural stimulation, the marketplace, you know, the commerce. I think people are going to continue to do that. I'm bullish still.
Can I ask you, as a leader and an African-American who took up this very important role, is that also a complicated thing for you to weave between? Because I presume there are many constituents who look to you and think you should be on their side and protecting their interests. But you are also, as you say, heavily involved in the policing of the city. So your time and your passion are demanded by all sorts of different constituents. Did you find it sometimes hard to look after all of those different interests? How is it sitting at the heart of a city like Washington, D.C., when there are so many demands being placed on you?
I think when you're a mayor, but I think any elected official, in my humble opinion, I think I was successful because you understand that on the one hand, you are elected by all the people to represent all the people all the time. And in certain ways, the majority of the time, you do represent all the people. Balance that with the fact that, you know, it's a democracy. Elections have consequences. You are elected on a platform and you're going to do certain things where 30% or maybe 40% of the people don't agree. That's called democracy. The key is being, again, open, above board, accessible to people, tell them exactly what you're going to do, and have people's respect. If those 40% of the people who don't agree with me on certain policies, if I'm still picking up their trash, policing their neighborhoods, doing the things they expect most of the time, then they understand, they respect me, that I'm not going to agree with them all the time. They may not even vote for me, but that's where the social compact will sustain itself and prevail. Where it doesn't happen is where, you know, it becomes us versus them. And there's this notion of, yes, I wasn't just elected to pursue my platform. I was elected to somehow or another vindicate some larger cause, and you're the enemy and you have to be vanquished. That's recipe for the disaster.
In your work now, you now work with the Federal City Council. You're running an organization. What's your involvement now in trying to shape cities? Could you explain to us your current role?
The Federal City Council was founded by Phil Graham, who was a son-in-law of Eugene Meyer, started the Washington Post. He was a husband of Catherine Graham, you know, of recent movie fame, Meryl Streep. The Graham family is a great family. They're a force for good in the city. They built the Washington Post into a great paper. And one of the first things they did in a series of articles in the paper, Phil Graham did a series of articles about, even in the 50s, Washington, D.C. was a city with a declining economy and a very unequal economy. There were these two-pronged problems, and he thought it was important to create a group, then men, you know, then white men, but now much broader, not even all business now, but much more of a non-governmental group of leaders. The idea is that they would lean in on the problems, the biggest problems with the biggest impact, where they could make the biggest difference. So they had to be really hard. They had to have a big impact in terms of their solution, and they had to make a difference. And over the years, you know, the creation of the Metro, the revitalization of Union Station, the recent refunding of the Metro, education reform, you know, major projects I could go, it would take me a long time to mention them all. Those are the kinds of things that the Federal City Council has and continues to do.
And tell me, when people look at a city like DC or any city, what would be your tips for mayors around the world as they look to refocus their ambitions, as they look to navigate these months ahead? Because city coffers are going to be short of cash if taxes, local taxes, are down. It's going to be impossible for central governments in many places to keep propping up businesses through furlough schemes, through state aid. It's going to be a moment of huge change. What would be your advice for mayors going forward over the coming weeks, months, years?
Well, if I were cities in really serious duress, I would work with my national government to set up intermediary mechanisms to help support and structure some of the tough decisions that have to be made that allow the city to renew its economy and achieve the social vision that a lot of us have. But you've got to have a strong economy to do that. And I think in order to build a strong economy in the short term, you have to make some tough choices. And working with national government, which isn't directly accountable to the people electorally in your city, may allow you to do that. I think the control board in D.C., people hate it and they like to denigrate it, but it did a lot of good. And out of the control board, we put a lot of mechanisms in place in Washington, D.C. We set aside legally reserves. We kept our finance office, like the Federal Reserve, for example, in the United States, removed from local political pressure. I think more governments need to think about doing that. you lose a little power, you know, right now, but in the long run, it's much better for your city and your economy performs much better.
My thanks to Anthony Williams, the former mayor of Washington, D.C., for joining us today. After the break, we turn our gaze to the West Coast and climate change. This is The Urbanist. As we've heard, the results of this election will have consequences far beyond the United States borders. And one of the issues which has been shaping up in the campaign and will have enormous domestic and global impact on the future of our planet and cities is climate change. From wildfires ravaging through the West Coast to rising sea levels threatening urban areas, climate change can no longer be ignored, and whoever is the president has the power to implement measures to counter our rapidly changing planet. Kathy Boffman-McLeod is a senior vice president at the Atlantic Council and the director of a climate-focused think tank, the Adrienne Arsht Rockefeller Resilience Centre. Let's have a listen.
The fire's moving faster than we can keep up, but we're recommending people that are threatened
get out. I hate to say our house is on fire.
So Obama's talking about all of this with the global warming and that.
Less than 12 years away from not being able to undo our mistakes.
The reverberations of that simple change are going to be enormous unless we do something about it.
The last 4 years of the Trump administration around climate change is focused on denial of climate change. He says that he doesn't believe in it and in the science, and he calls it a hoax.
I wish science agreed with you.
Hey, well, I don't think science knows, actually.
The narrative is to deride climate action and climate activists as alarmists.
Please respect, and I know you do, the difference of opinion.
And any climate action to be expensive and harmful to the U.S. economy.
Every year, I get the call, California's burning, California's burning.
California stands alone, I'd have to say, in its climate policy and environmental regulations and a focus on the environment. So they have agreements and treaties and economic compacts on renewable energy and emissions reductions with other states in the West, but also with Canada and Mexico. And so they act independently and they have their own carbon emissions regulations. But in terms of the impacts of climate change, now looking at the climate adaptation side, the smoke, the fires, the heat, those are things that will absolutely be impacted by a second term of President Trump.
Red flag fire warnings tonight in Southern California, where a new wildfire
country triggered.
Kristen, good morning to you. The two largest wildfires in Colorado.
In terms of talking about specific states, beyond the dramatic climate impacts in California, the sea level rise and the extreme heat and the hurricanes that affect other parts of the U.S. are another big factor of just raw impact and pain and suffering to Americans from climate-driven extreme weather. 40% of the U.S. lives in a coastal county, and so it's beyond California. We will see cities increasingly take matters into their own hands around climate change, and they are, in fact, doing that. But the challenge of climate change is that it is a global impact. And so cities can reduce their emissions and invest in climate smart infrastructure and transition to as much renewable energy as they can. But the whole world needs to be doing it too. And I think we will see big investments and shifts to climate adaptation as the temperature rise that's already baked in from our emissions to date means more infrastructure needs to protect coastlines and raise infrastructure and cool cities with forests. And so all kinds of adaptive measures we'll see in cities. But this election is perhaps the most important in our history around the future of the United States around climate change and impacts and the world. I don't think that the U.S. can take another 4 years of the denial policy and the rollback of environmental regulations. This is a make or break moment for climate change in the U.S.
That was Kathy Boffman-McLeod of the Atlantic Council. Well, that's all we have for this edition of the programme. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Rabello and David Stevens, and David also edited the show. And to play you out of this week's episode, here's Childish Gambino with This Is America. Thank you for listening, City Lovers. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping up. This is America.